You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you in part by Santa Fe County. If you've been looking to go solar in your home, Santa Fe County's Sustainability Office wants you to know that the 30% federal tax incentives are only available until the end of 2019. So if you've been thinking about going solar, now's the time to do it. And if you're not sure where to start, start with Santa Fe County's Office of Sustainability, where you can get a free impartial consultation to help demystify the process and help you calculate upfront just how big a system you might need. Contact them at 992-9832 or visit santafecountynm.gov/publicworks. And the Radio Cafe is also brought to you by Morningstar Senior Living, which is building its newest community on Pacheco Street in Santa Fe. They'll be providing independent living, assisted living, and memory care to make sure that you and your loved ones can live fully and vibrantly in a safe environment. You can reach Morningstar Senior Living at 505-919-7989. That's 505-919-7989, or go to morningstarseniorliving.com and let them know that you heard about it on the Radio Cafe. And by the way, if you'd like to sponsor the Radio Cafe, please contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can reach him at 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican, and all that info is there. And now to our program. We're going to be talking today to Phyllis Bennis. She's director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. And every once in a while, she visits Santa Fe, and I had the good fortune to talk to her a couple of days ago. Welcome, Phyllis Bennis, to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be with you.
Good to have you back. Now, it's almost like Groundhog Day when you talk about Israel and Palestine. I mean, it's almost like you could open the paper any year, any decade, and have similar news. And yet there's also some very significant shifts to talk about. Describe what's going on right now and why now. We had very recently a situation in which on one day, 60 Palestinians were killed, 2,400 injured, all by Israeli soldiers.
It was one of the worst days in Palestinian history for many, many years. It's true, there's an aspect of Groundhog Day. This sort of crisis hits occasionally, and then again, and then again, and then again. The problem is, each time it gets worse. It's not the same. Each time it's worse. And there's no recouping those losses. So what we had in this case was a coalescence of factors. This was the last week of a six-week set of protests that were designed many months ago by civil society activists in Gaza who were tired of the way they're forced to live without electricity, without water, without sufficient food, without sufficient medicine, and most important of all, without any ability to get out of this open-air prison, which is the Gaza Strip, where almost 2 million Palestinians live under complete Israeli siege. It's not a traditional occupation in the sense of Israeli soldiers being inside the strip. They were redeployed to just outside the strip, so they keep it under a constant state of siege. The Palestinians in Gaza, like the Palestinians on the West Bank, have no control over their borders, over who or what comes in or goes out, meaning goods and services, people, nothing. They don't control the water. They don't control the airspace. And it has created an enormous humanitarian crisis, where the United Nations has said that by 2020, and some estimates are even sooner than that, meaning within the next year or so, Gaza will become unlivable. But there is no plan B. There's no options that Gazans have. So in response to that, young activists decided to carry out a set of protests of their imprisonment in this open-air prison. And they focused on what Palestinians call the Nakba, which is, it means the catastrophe in Arabic, and it refers to the displacement, the forced dispossession, the forced expulsion of about 750,000 Palestinians in 1947 and 48 at the time that Israel was created. And of course, at the end of that war, Israel then controlled 78% of historic Palestine, which it controlled until 1967, where it then took over the remaining 22%. So in that context, the Nakba or the catastrophe continues because 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees from that era. They are completely dependent for food, medicine, education on outside aid because they are not allowed to create an indigenous economy. And it's been a disaster. Israel apparently believes that if they announce ahead of time that they intend to violate international law by using live fire to shoot to kill unarmed protesters on their own land, that makes it okay. Right. If we say we're going to do it, then it's okay that we do it. We gave you warning. That's not okay. That's a violation of international law, a violation of the Geneva Conventions, and clearly a war crime. And that's what we saw coming to a head on that one day, on that one Monday, when we had those incredible, horrifying statistics that you mentioned. What had happened before that, the day before that, was the decision coming to fruition of the United States to move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, breaking international law, breaking U.S. political consensus that goes back 30 or 40 years, actually going back to the founding of the State of Israel with a brief interlude at one moment. And in that context, the tensions were far higher. So we saw this kind of split screen where on the one hand, there were the Trump minions, his family lawyer, who's now the ambassador to Israel, who were celebrating with Bibi Netanyahu, all grinning, smiling, happy for the cameras, cut across to the people of Gaza, where you saw teenagers being carrying each other on stretchers out of the what was starting to look like a war zone, although it was only a one-way attack. These were unarmed Palestinians. One Israeli soldier now, after 6 weeks, has reported having been hit by a small stone. That's as far as anybody has even claimed that there was any injuries on the Israeli side. And this kind of assault with thousands of civilian casualties, dozens dead, the use of live fire, enormous numbers of amputations because the hospitals are unable to carry out the kind of complicated surgeries they need from these bullets that are designed to explode inside the body and maximize the damage. They can't do it. They don't have the supplies. They don't have the equipment. They don't have the medicines.
And we're talking about partly, shootings of a lot of children, a lot of young people.
Of the 60 people killed, I think the latest count was that 11 were children. And some of them were, all of them under 18. Some were teenagers. One was an 8-month-old baby who died as the result of tear gas inhalation. Others were an 8-year-old boy. There was a 14-year-old girl. It's just a horrifying litany. And the Palestinians, what was so extraordinary was seeing them, and it was covered so widely in the alternative media, but even this time, mainstream media sources throughout the United States, throughout Europe, throughout the entire world, was covering what went on in Gaza. And the Palestinians kept going back, knowing that they were going into the line of fire unarmed, with no weapons, with no protection. They were not soldiers. They are ordinary civilians, whole families, because they were desperate. And that desperation led to this extraordinary effort to say, we are here, we are human, we have our human rights. This is our land. You know, ironically, Mary Charlotte, it's extraordinary. When you look at the actual maps of where people were, there were all these claims from the Israelis, well, no country would do anything different because no country could allow thousands of people to just charge across their border. Well, nobody had charged across any border. Number one, Israel doesn't have borders. Israel's the only country in the world that has never declared its own borders. So this is not a border. Now, there is a boundary line that's been set by the Israelis based on the 1949 armistice. This is somewhat close to that line. It's not entirely that. But then the Israelis built what they call a buffer zone inside Gaza that's up to about 300 yards wide. And collectively, it takes up about 20% of the best arable land in Gaza. And there's very little arable land in Gaza. They now have access to only 80% of that little bit because the Israelis now have the rest. People were in that buffer zone on their own land. Nobody was inside Israel. So this notion that it's somehow okay for the Israelis to just fire away at large numbers of people, frankly, even if some people had breached the border, that does not give them the right under international law, under any international law, to shoot to kill. Shooting to kill is limited only if there's an immediate threat to the life of another person. a threat to a fence doesn't count.
And kind of Gandhian level peaceful protest of people taking their lives into their own hands and going into, as you say, the line of fire and being shot for it. Now that there's this media coverage that is greater than it has been in the past, do you think that's making a difference?
Well, I think it has an enormous impact on the discourse. We've already seen huge discourse shifts in the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 15 years. The media coverage in general is still very bad. It still has a pro-Israel bias that is so entrenched that it's often not even recognized. But right now, that's different. We see the word Nakba in the mainstream press all the time. That was never the case before. People forget what an extraordinary moment it was to see that in the New York Times for the first time. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago. So there have been enormous shifts. You know, when this sort of thing happens, it's very similar to the years of the first Palestinian uprising, what was called the Intifada. Now, like the first Intifada, this demonstration was not completely peaceful in the sense that there were some kids who threw stones, there were some kids who tried to send flaming kites over the fence. It did no damage. Nobody was hurt. And the notion that somehow a child with a stone against an armed tank, against soldiers in full protection gear, against snipers, against sharpshooters, this to me is still a peaceful protest. I think it's important that we clarify. People will come back and say, well, some of those children had stones. Yes, they did. And I would say that a child throwing a stone against a tank is fine with me.
The United States sends the Israeli military billions of dollars every year. What does the U.S. get in return? I mean, that's a transaction.
It's an interesting question, and it's interesting not least because so few journalists ever ask it. It's an important question because it does go to the question of, is it in U.S. national interests to continue to send a starting point of $3.8 billion a year, which is the congressionally mandated amount, plus millions more in other military support, directly to the Israeli military every year, as we do, our tax money. In that context, what the U.S. government officials will say we get out of it is they are our ally. We share values. And I always want to say, really? We share the value of sending sharpshooters against unarmed children? And then I remember, sometimes we do that, so maybe we do share those values. The values of claiming someone else's land and making it your own, we share that value. That was how the U.S. came to be created. So, we share certain things with Israel. The notion that somehow it makes us safer in a military or strategic sense is clearly not the case. The close relationship between the U.S. and Israel makes the U.S. complicit in Israeli war crimes. This isn't just something, some sort of rhetorical remark that somebody might say, some Palestinian or someone in the Arab world or someone in Europe might say, the U.S. is complicit. It's an actual legal position that when you provide the weapons knowing that they are being used for illegal purposes, you are complicit. We pay 20% of the Israeli military budget. That makes us at least 20% complicit in what that military does. The U.S. has a law, it's called the Leahy Law, that was passed many years ago, that is a human rights law. It's a very important law that Senator Patrick Leahy, who's still in the Senate, championed. And what the law says is that it's prohibited for the U.S. to send any military support to a country if it goes to a military unit known to have carried out human rights violations in a systematic or consistent way. The Israeli violations are enormously illegal, enormously consistent, enormously pattern and practice, as the law goes. What we've heard, and I don't have confirmation on this, but it does stand to reason it would be true, what we've heard from some inside Israel is that on this occasion, because it was announced ahead of time that Israel would be sending sharpshooters to the Gaza fence, long before any protester had ever emerged, this was weeks before the protests began, they announced it, and we heard that they were sending sharpshooters from a wide variety of military units rather than one unit. And I can only assume that the only reason that that makes sense is so that the Leahy Law would not apply because there's no one unit that can be identified. Now, the Leahy Law has never been used successfully against Israel despite the consistency of its international law violations and its reliance on U.S. funding and U.S. weapons for those violations. You know, under the terms of U.S. military assistance law, most countries have to spend all the money that we give them in the U.S. So it has to spend it with Raytheon or Boeing or McDonnell Douglas, all the other arms manufacturers in the United States.
And that's what we call aid?
That's what we call aid. It's really a kind of corporate welfare for military corporations in the U.S. Israel is the one exception. Israel is allowed to spend 25% of the aid on its own weapons, because Israel is a huge exporter of weapon systems anyway. So they spend 25% of it on their own, competing with U.S. weapons manufacturers, and the other 75% it spends in the U.S. So it's buying U.S. weapons to commit war crimes. We are complicit in that. We have to take responsibility for that.
So back to the question of what the U.S. is getting out of this billions of dollars transactions, I had a guest on some years ago on this show who was talking about the fact that the Israeli intelligence services are kind of mean and lean and are not a bloated bureaucracy the way we have in the United States. I don't know about the bloated bureaucracy of the U.S. intelligence services, but there are about 17 of them. And that's one of the reasons, that's like part of what we're getting out of it. I mean, again, the question of spending those billions for shared values, it's like nobody does that just out. I mean, there's no foreign aid or whatever just for shared values.
That's absolutely right. There is foreign aid that is linked to political pressure. That's not the only reason. There's also strategic reasons, but certainly the pressure of pro-Israel lobbies, both the traditional Jewish lobbies, AIPAC, the Council of Presidents, and others. Those are not themselves lobbies, but they organize lobbies to send money directly to members of Congress. That plays a huge role. And the Christian Zionist organizations, Kufi and others, who have enormous influence in Congress, they play a role. But it's also true that the collaboration between the U.S. and Israel militarily, on the intelligence level, as you mentioned, those are very real. We should point out, number one, that that leads most of the time to illegal acts. So whether that's, again, in the national interest of the United States or only in the very narrow interests of the intelligence agencies themselves is a very uncertain question. I think that we also have to look at the issue of the collaboration that's now underway, led by the Anti-Defamation League and others, to arrange trainings, joint trainings of local police from the United States. Local city police agencies are urged to send their police forces to Israel to be trained by the Israeli military and Israeli border police in such things as counterterrorism, how to deal with large-scale protests, and the notion that, first of all, that our police needs the training by Israeli forces to learn how to repress demonstrations is a bit laughable. But aside from that, it means that we are choosing to send our police to be trained in the kind of tactics that Israel uses, and Israel is suppressing an occupied population. Is that how we want our local police to treat our populations here? I don't think so. But that's what that kind of training and that kind of collaboration can lead to.
So it's another piece of the militarization of police that's not just about equipment and having tanks, but about the kind of tactics that you use in a war zone as opposed to policing, which is, in theory, a civilian activity.
Exactly right. And it's a very important point. It's the reason that Jewish Voice for Peace is leading, with a number of other organizations, a campaign called Deadly Exchange that's aimed at stopping this Israel-U.S. collaboration, particularly the role of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, in putting it forward, that's aimed at broadening access to these trainings, raising the money to send local police to Israel for this training. It's the same problem that we face with the militarization of local police in their relations with the Pentagon. The Pentagon has something called the 1033 rule, which allows the Defense Department to send leftover military equipment that's brought home, say, from Afghanistan, to local police forces who might want to use it. And that can be anything from a leftover car to an armored personnel carrier to weapons. That's the reason that there was an armored personnel carrier on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown was killed. Why would the Ferguson Police Department need an armored personnel carrier? They don't. But somebody at the Pentagon called and said, hey, you guys want an armored personnel carrier? And somebody in the Ferguson Police Department said, hey, yeah, that would be cool. We'll take one of those. We'll figure out when to use it. And they used it. So this militarization of our society is taking place at so many different levels. It's part of the reason that it's so important that widespread organizations like the Poor People's Campaign are taking up, along with racism, poverty, and environmental destruction, the question of militarism. This was one of the lessons from Dr. Martin Luther King, who talked in his famous speech at Riverside Church in 1967, when he came out against the war in Vietnam, and he said, we have to fight against the evil triplets of racism, poverty, and militarism. Militarism is everywhere in this country, and it's a huge challenge, and aid to Israel is part of it.
You've talked quite a lot about war crimes, about international law. What is the role of international law? Can it be enforced? It seems to be pretty ineffective, especially where the United States and Israel are concerned, and that's nothing new.
It's not very effective. The problem with international law, like any law, is that it only exists on paper until somebody is prepared to fight for it. One of the important things about international law is that other countries take it much more seriously than we do. So that's something that gives me a little bit of hope. In this country, I think international law is most important as a tool for civil society and social movements to challenge unjust U.S. laws. You know, one of the U.S. fundamental parts of our Constitution says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. That means that things like the United Nations Charter is law in this country. It's domestic law as well as international law. But it strengthens us when we can point to international law that the U.S. claims on other occasions it's prepared to go to war to enforce, and yet claims to be not even accountable to it. Why? Because we're the biggest, richest, strongest military in the world. So why should we be? And that's not okay. So international law is a way of making us like other countries, saying we're not the Colossus of Rome standing over every other country. We want to be one country like every other. Yes, we're larger. Yes, we're stronger. Yes, we're richer. That brings with it obligations, not privileges. And that's what we have to fight for, and international law is one tool in that fight.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. And we're just going to take a quick break to tell you that the Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. We've had a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies, but very little moisture, and the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. You can visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. Once again, that's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And now back to our program. We're looking at something that could become kind of a perfect storm, which is, I mean, you look at the move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, you look at the ending of the Iran nuclear deal, you look at the whole situation in North Korea. How do you see the geopolitical dangers of these various elements coming together, particularly with respect to Iran and Israel?
Well, I'm glad you raised that question. It's the fundamental component of the strategic relationship between the U.S. and Israel right now. It's building up the anti-Iran alliance. So we see it particularly dangerous right now as the U.S. not only consolidates its already tight as tight can be relationship with Israel, it's encouraging and sponsoring a new, or I should say newly public, because it's been hovering in the background secretly for quite some years, a new relationship between Israel and the key monarchies of the Arab world, the key Sunni monarchies plus Egypt. These are governments that have long wanted to normalize relations with Israel, but thought they couldn't get away with it and stay in power because their populations would be so outraged at the collaboration between their own governments, already incredibly repressive, non-democratic, etc., absolute monarchies, no human rights, but also who claimed once to have some kind of lip service towards Palestinian rights. If they broke with that and said, and now we're going to embrace Israel as our partner, they were afraid there would be just all hell to pay, and they could be overturned even in revolutionary movements or something else. These days, it seems they're not even worried about public opinion. Repression has grown in all of those countries, and the rise of Iran's role as a enemy du jour or enemy of the year, if you will, of the United States, of Israel, of Saudi Arabia, of the UAE. Across the region, the rise of this anti-Iran coalition is very, very threatening. And when you have the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal in that context, it raises the threat level even higher. It raises the threat, not because Iran is about to go off and rebuild its nuclear power program. It was never a nuclear weapons program. It didn't have a nuclear weapon. Israel is the only nuclear weapon state in the region, which is very important because it's a very destabilizing reality in that region. It's very, very dangerous. And of course, the U.S. backs that nuclear arsenal, the Israeli nuclear arsenal. But the idea that the U.S. pullout from the Iran nuclear deal is somehow going to lead to what Trump likes to call a better deal is simply not going to happen. There's no better deal out there. This was the best deal that was possible. The Iranians haven't changed. China and Russia haven't changed. Europe hasn't changed. Nobody is prepared to renegotiate, reopen those negotiations. It ain't going to happen. That's the deal we got. And the U.S. says, nope, we don't want that deal. So they're walking away from it. Iran is still within it, is still abiding by it. And the U.S., in fact, had, of course, agreed that Iran was abiding by the terms of the deal. The problem was they didn't like the deal. They didn't like what it called for. They didn't like what it didn't call for. So that's what's changed. And it's a very, very dangerous thing. It also sets a very bad precedent in terms of relations with North Korea. We hear that the White House has just announced that it is canceling the meeting with North Korea. That's an incredibly dangerous move. And we don't know where that's going to go. But the notion that North Korea is going to be more eager to deal with the United States diplomatically when it pulls out of earlier agreements is simply nonsense. It's quite the opposite.
Well, many people who are observing the Trump administration are perceiving that their main goal is to undo everything Obama did, good or bad. And for those of us who are ordinary citizens, ordinary journalists who are not foreign policy experts, observing all this, it kind of looks like schoolyard logic. Because, I mean, foreign policy is hard. This is your area of expertise. There are many people who spend years of their lives studying to try to understand how nations relate to each other.
Sure.
And it's complicated for many reasons that are cultural and historical and emotional and geopolitical and resource management and all of those different things.
Absolutely.
And so on some level, it's kind of like, okay, I defer to you. What's right? Let's talk this out. But when I look at this and when so many people look at it, it's like, is there any logic at all except let's undo Obama?
There's a little bit of very dangerous logic of power. There is a lot of political logic, exactly what you're saying. We want to undo everything Obama stood for and prove that we can make this a different, better place for our people. And that's a very narrow sector of people in this country. We should keep in mind that Trump is trying to make America great for. He's talking about going back to the 1950s when white people were in unconditional positions of power, where people of color had virtually no rights, where women had virtually no rights, where LGBT people were not allowed out of the closet. All of those things. So for those people who want to go back to that era, this is perhaps making America ours again. It's also making America a war country again. You want to go back to war? That's how you do it. You want to threaten other countries? There are consequences. You may not understand what they are. You may not know what the history is. You may not know that in Iran, people to this day, three generations later, look at what the U.S. did in 1953 with orchestrating the overthrow of a democratically elected leader and imposing a U.S.-backed Shah of Iran is still the lens through which Iranians look at U.S. government policy. Ironically, Iranian people tend to be more pro-U.S. in the broad scheme of culture and all those kinds of things than anywhere else in the Middle East. But when you ask Iranians what they think about U.S. policy towards their country, they start in 1953. I'm pretty sure that the Trump administration is not really thinking very much about what the U.S. did to Iran in 1953. So you have a huge challenge. And certainly the political goal is part of this. You also see paying off specific political backers. What Trump did with moving the embassy had everything to do with Sheldon Adelson, the the Miami casino mogul, who billionaire, who has funded the Trump administration and funded the far right and funds Israel and Israeli settlements massively. He has been pushing for this for a long time. He's one of the people who pushed for David Friedman to be the ambassador. He was there grinning away on television on that split screen where Gazans are being slaughtered on one side and the Trump family is celebrating on the other side with Sheldon Adelson and his wife, who are there among their key supporters. So did this have everything to do with Sheldon Adelson? Absolutely. But is it also part of building up the relationship with the right-wing government of Israel in the context of building an anti-Iran alliance? Yes, absolutely there too.
And if I may say so, when you really think about the quality of life of the white Americans who voted for Trump, it's not clear that those people are really benefiting from these kinds of policies.
Absolutely right. This is the irony here. There's claims often using racism as the basis for building support for economic policies, the tax policy, that are hurting people of color in far higher levels, but are hurting far more white people just because of the disparity of population numbers. And people are being hoodwinked. There's no question about it. How long it takes before people start to realize that it's not only people of color where they're fine with hurting immigrants, hurting black people, hurting Muslims. It's not going to be only those people. Those people are being hurt hardest and hurt most. But eventually, the white people who supported those policies are being hurt as well.
Is there anything in all of this that gives you hope or that seems like a movement that people can join onto and become more aware and proactive about what's going on?
Absolutely. You know, if we start with looking at what our country is, I think the great historian Howard Zinn had the best way of capturing it. He said, our country has always been characterized by two threads. On the one hand, you have the history of this country being grounded in genocide and slavery. On the other hand, this has always been a country built on movements against genocide and slavery, and against racism and sexism and environmental destruction and all of those things. We have built movements to challenge all that. Often we've won, sometimes we haven't, but we keep on fighting against wars, against racism. And what's been extraordinary in this Trump era is that we have seen an escalation of both threads. We've seen dangers of massive escalation in attacks against people of color, against immigrants, against Muslims, against women, against LGBT people. We've also seen a rise in all of the movements representing those rights. One of the great movements right now that is perhaps one of the most intersectional is the Poor People's Campaign, which I mentioned earlier, led by Reverend Liz Theo Harris and Reverend William Barber. In that movement, those intersecting movements against racism, against poverty, against militarism, and against climate degradation are all looked at through a joint lens. We at IPS were privileged to be the institutional partners of the Poor People's Campaign in producing an audit of the 50 years since Dr. King's Poor People Campaign of 1968. And we looked at those four areas in their connection. So I worked on the section on militarism, and we looked at the impact of militarism, particularly on women. We looked at what the environmental impact is of military bases around the world. We looked at the question of the disproportionality of people of color in various periods being pushed into the military. In the section dealing with racism, we looked at the question of how racism disproportionately affects women. We looked at the issue of the school-to-prison pipeline, how that affects young people. So we're looking at all of these connections. And the Poor People's Campaign right now is about to go into week three of a 6-week period where in Washington, D.C. and 30 capitals around the country, people are going to acts of civil disobedience in their state capital, demanding change in all of these arenas. And people can find out about it here in Santa Fe, in Albuquerque, in New Mexico. The Poor People's Campaign is carrying out a host of different actions and different kinds of activities. People can find it on the website, poorpeoplescampaign.org. It's divided by states, and it's a great opportunity.
Phyllis Bennis is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're on the web at ips-dc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.